years after the San Francisco-based Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra was formed, Nicholas McGeegan was hired to be their first music director. 35 years later, he's still finding ways to keep the musicians and the audience on their toes. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. I'm talking with Nick McGeegan. He's the music director for the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra. Tell me what your goal has been since the time you were hired with this ensemble.
Well, I was hired as the first music director because before that, it was a, shall we say, a little bit of a Berkeley commune. Rehearsals were a little bit like Quaker meetings where everyone's spirit moved them to talk, which meant that after a week's rehearsal, basically nothing got done. And so they decided they actually wanted somebody to take some decisions, and that was my job. So they hired me as a benign tyrant. And that's what I've been ever since, I trust, to make sure that the rehearsals, I choose the repertoire, I hire the musicians, do the auditions, all that stuff. But also, more musically, I've been developing what I think of as the Philharmonia style, Philharmonia sound and style. Many of our players have actually been in the orchestra, well, some of our players have been in the orchestra longer than I have. So we've got a very loyal team. And so, whereas sometimes with modern symphony orchestras you can't tell the difference between one and the other, I think with period instrument orchestras, and particularly mine, I think we don't sound like anybody else. And that's one of the things that I try to achieve, and I think it's been largely very successful.
So how have you kept the musicians and maybe even the audience on their toes over the past 30 plus years?
Well, one thing is that you have to have you're never going to please everybody. Within the period of music that we play, you have to provide as wide and as varied a number of options as possible. It's a little bit like running a restaurant. You have to have the vegetarian option, the gluten-free. You have people who like choral music, people who hate choral music, people who like opera, people who hate opera, people who only want you to play Telemann. You're not going to please everybody all the time. So you have to have this sort of really good range. And one of the first things I did was actually to start playing classical music as opposed to Baroque music. We had some people who really didn't want us to do that. They said, you know, if you're going to play Mozart, I'd rather hear it at the symphony. Well, we play it differently, so, you know, just enjoy it. And enjoy the differences, perhaps. It's good to challenge the musicians. I think it's good to challenge the audience. We have a whole series of new music written for old instruments. So we have composers who come in and work with us to play music that's fresh off the page. And that's, we're one of the very few period instrument orchestras actually to do that. And that keeps our musicians on their toes. It also gives them a chance actually to work with live composers, which normally we wouldn't do. Normally we're just good at working with the dead ones. And of course, it annoys some of our audience, and it delights other ones. It should be as if everything's same old, or in our case, same very old, it gets a little stale after a while, I think.
Well, you love introducing the audience to new things, and one of your recent projects was the world premiere of the French Baroque opera composer Jean-Philippe Rameau's original 1745 version of the Temple of Glory. And one of the things that made this even more special was the libretto was by another superstar, Voltaire. Tell me how this all started to come together.
Well, it came about in stages. First of all, back almost in 1991, I think, one of our chorus, who was then a graduate student at UC Berkeley, studying Jean-Philippe Rameau, and he knew that I'd done some work on Rameau in the 80s, said, you know, there's a Rameau manuscript at UC Berkeley, and it's of this piece called The Temple of Glory, and it seems to be an unknown version of the piece. So he took a look at it and did some work on it and realized that it's a unique score of the original version that was done in front of the king in 1745 in Versailles. The later version is the only one that's been published subsequently, and it's also been recorded, but that's been kind of glitzed up for the Paris audience with extra frou-frou, shall we say, extra dancing shepherdesses, and it diffuses the libretto quite a lot. So back in the 90s then, we were able to record some of the dance music from this 1745 version directly from this manuscript, and we Harmonia Mundi issued that. And then we sort of said, well, it'd be lovely to do a concert performance of this sometime, wouldn't it? And but there wasn't a constituency for it or the money. And then it sort of came, well, if we do a concert performance, wouldn't it be even better to do a staged performance? Because it's never been staged in this version anywhere. And slowly you build together a constituency of different, like, building bricks. Matthias Tarnopolsky, a wonderful guy, came to run Cal Performances, and he was very keen to do this, to show how wonderful UC Berkeley was for the arts, doing this exciting project which originates in Berkeley, because that's where the score is. And then along came my friends, Catherine Turozzi and so on, the design and production team with whom I've worked since 1985. And then the Center for Baroque Music in Versailles came along and said, look, we're thinking of publishing this, an edition of this piece. We'd love to, could you beta test it for us, basically? And we've also got a lot of fantastic French singers who would jump at the chance of coming to sing it. And their director is an expert on 18th century French rhetoric and can work on exactly how to pronounce the text and make it shine in the most wonderful way. So all the component parts came together. I went to Paris to rehearse it. And then 5 months later, we brought it to Berkeley to actually put the whole thing together. And the result is the three performances that we gave. And now the recording that's out.
And all three of those performances were sold out. How did you manage to do that with something that was probably unfamiliar to audiences?
Of course, Philharmonia has its own following, and we play each one of our concerts four times in the Bay Area, so we had a built-in audience there. There's a big audience for dance here, and so there's a big dance following, and this manages to push all the buttons. It's Baroque, it's Philharmonia fans, it's opera fans, and it's dance fans. And the word premiere isn't so bad either. And so we filled out, 2,500 people a night came to see it.
In this opera, Voltaire is sending a message to King Louis XV. Could you talk about that and how he was able to make his point?
You have to make points to a king very carefully and relatively subtly, but the king got it. That year, 1745, the French had won a battle. It was something they didn't do very often until Napoleon came along. And so they decided they'd celebrate big time. And that means you do it at the court, where everybody who's anybody lives. And so they put on this opera, got Voltaire, the most famous writer in France, and Jean-Philippe Rameau, the most famous composer of the time, to collaborate, which they didn't do very easily. They were both quite cranky. And the story isn't a story like an opera that we think of, boy meets girl, dad intervenes, and if it's an 18th century opera, they get married, and if it's a 19th century opera, she dies of tuberculosis. It's much more a message opera. And so it's in a prologue and in three acts, but it's all really on the same subject, which is what are the characteristics of a good ruler, particularly a king who has just won a big battle. It's all very well to be victorious, but where do you go from there? So the prologue sets that up with the question, who rules? How do you rule? And what are the qualities you need? Act 1 and Act 2 present two deeply unsuitable candidates. The first one is a bloodthirsty thug. You might say in modern terms a Russian oligarch. The second act presents Bacchus, who's much too drunk and much too interested in his lady friends to do any work. He's got all the trappings of kingship and almost all the money, but he's actually not doing anything except having parties all the time. And the third act is, okay, so let's present somebody who's really good at it. And the Emperor Trajan won a battle, but released his captors, magnanimous in victory, nice to the girls, and was a wise and fair ruler. Point to Louis the 15th. You're a little bit like Act 1 and 2, but you need to be like Act 3. And Louis the 15th didn't terribly like that. He was particularly good at having lots of mistresses, and this is showing that maybe that's not such a great way to run a government. It actually meant, rather amusingly, that some of the lines from 1745 still had a bit of a point and got applause. Even in 2017.
What exactly is the Temple of Glory?
That is where you go if you're a good ruler. It's like, it's in sporty terms, you could say it's the governmental hall of fame.
But Glory is actually a character too, right?
Yes, she is a character. But first, the bad characters want to enter the Temple of Glory, and they're told they can't. But Glory then welcomes Trajan at the end.
And then she is, what, doesn't she open the temple to everybody?
She opens the temple up to everybody and says that everybody under this benign rule of Trajan can partake in the goodies of life.
So how is this message still relevant today?
Well, who makes a good ruler is always a question. Shall we just say, as we're talking, I'm as a British person dealing with Brexit. What makes a good ruler is somewhat in question, I would say there. But it is what are the good qualities for the job, basically in any job, that is an eternal message. Certainly, with Roman emperors, Trajan is one of the few who was a good emperor. There weren't too many. So he's held up as a paragon of being a good ruler, and I think that's fine. And, of course, in France, when you've got the absolute ancien regime with an absolute monarch whose word is law, Voltaire is pointing, saying, you better live up to it, Louis. And the whole of the end, which is where the temple opens and Trajan is admitted to the governmental hall of fame. There's a wonderful bit where his defeated kings are released and told to go back and rule under him. And it's a lovely mixture also of music and dance, because the French absolutely loved dance. And so there's an enormous Pascal at the end, Pascalia, with singing in it, basically saying every age, both sexes should be treated equally and be entitled to all the goodness of the earth, which is not a message that was necessarily thought good by the kings and princes of the 18th century. They were quite happy to keep all the goodies for themselves.
I'm Julie Almacher, and this is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode.